It's the Burt Cohen Show. Sometimes the dream really gets a little bit twisted. Do you ever have really crazy dreams? Well, it seems like the dream of our founders has been rather twisted. Democracy, republic. We're not supposed to be an empire. That was not what the intention was. We're supposed to avoid foreign entanglements. Well, a lot of that energy, we've made a lot of people angry across the world. We, the United States government, not you and me, but it seems like it may be coming home to roost. And maybe we read about all these things going on all across the world. Maybe there's some sort of connection, some sort of common thread, maybe something very positive from it. Well, we're going to find out today, I think. I'm very pleased to have guests sharing a line, Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers, who wrote a very interesting and thought-provoking article in Alternate, The Subjects of American Empire Are Joining in Solidarity. Thank you, Kevin and Margaret, for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us.
Well, it's interesting. I was telling my daughter about the summer of 1968, you know, how exciting it was. And she was kind of envious. And I told her, you know, the way things are going now with the uprisings, people waking up everywhere, perhaps something like that is happening again. And for those who may not know, Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers are participants in PopularResistance.org. They co-direct It's Our Economy and co-host Clearing the Fog, which is shown on Ustream TV and heard on radio, as well as here. You recently, in this article in Alternate, you said, we are all subjects of the American empire. Whether we live in North America, South America, Asia, Europe, the Middle East, we are all under the thumb of neoliberal capitalism that puts concentrated corporate power in control of our lives. I wonder if you could, first, I mean, there's a lot of important words there to define. Could you define what it is that we've all gotten so used to? We become so accepting of being, as you say, all subjects of the American empire. I wonder if you could define some of those terms in that loaded phrase.
Sure, thank you. Well, I think one topic that's not discussed enough in this country, or very much at all, is the fact that America is a vast empire. It's the greatest empire in world history. You know, we have over 1,000 bases and outposts all over the world. You know, we have multinational corporations dominating the economy, the global economy. And now we know that, you know, our spying network is, you know, covers the entire globe, including within the United States. Yes. What the, you know, kind of the U.S. economic policy has been really coming out of the late 1940s, but, you know, in earnest in the 70s and moving forward, is this kind of neoliberal economic policy, which really forces countries to privatize their resources for large corporations, and in doing that, also hand-in-hand goes defunding their public programs for important necessities like education, health, things like that. And that's been kind of our, you know, what we've been imposing on the global South and big finance, not just the United States, but we're certainly the dominant player, has been imposing on the global South for a long time, taking their resources, taking that money out of those countries, putting them into debt, and forcing them to defund things that their people need. It's been increasing poverty around the world. And what we see now is that those same policies that we've been imposing elsewhere are being imposed here in the United States. And, you know, it's our extraction economy for extreme ways of trying to get fossil-based energy, you know, really is taking off, putting our entire environment at risk, as we see this push for austerity measures to cut our vital programs when that's not absolutely actually needed at all, but we're led to believe that it is needed. These are things that are now coming home, and it's really kind of this kind of shared crisis of capitalism around the world that we're all experiencing that connects us, and we just see the same picture rolling out over and over in so many countries.
And you write that, quote, capitalism is failing, and the people must take control to create the kind of world in which we want to live. Now, Kevin and Margaret, that's a lot easier to say than to make real. There may be, and there appears to be, great clarity as to what people are against, this kind of neoliberal domination by the corporations with the U.S. and the U.K. as well, to a lesser extent, formerly Great Britain. They used to have a pretty good empire, too. But, you know, people are clear what they're against. But what are people in the streets for? Articulating, quote, the kind of world in which we want to live, unquote, is infinitely more challenging, is it not? Is there a common theme for this aspect of the worldwide protests?
Well, that's a really great question. And in fact, I think it's so common with transformational moments in history that you don't know what comes after the transformation. I mean, I don't think the American colonists knew what they'd end up with. I don't think the people of Poland and Solidarity knew what they'd end up with, or South Africa. Any time there's a major change, it's hard to predict the future. But what we can see is the roots of the future already taking shape, because one thing we advocate on popularresistance.org is that we have to do two things at once. We have to both protest what we don't like and build what we want, build the world we want to see. And what we're seeing being built is what we call economic democracy. And we really focus on that on our economic site. It's oureconomy.us, and define it under the section of issues on the front page. Economic democracy basically gives people greater control over their own economic lives, greater influence over the direction of their own local and national economies. And so it's things like worker-owned cooperatives. It's changing corporate welfare into taxpayer investments. So just like in Alaska, they've been doing some things in 1989 with the Alaska Permanent Trust. People, when the taxpayer invests in the economy, they get a share of the wealth in an annual check. And there's a whole series of changes we'd want to see made, and people are advocating for things like a transparent Federal Reserve that's accountable democratically. People participatory budgeting, which is being used at the local level to allow people to start to make decisions on how tax dollars are spent, not just participate in advising, but actually voting on how the budget is spent. So I think we're moving in that direction toward greater freedom, greater autonomy, and greater economic democracy. So that's the kind of world we're going toward, and it's much bigger than the Occupy movement. It's been developing for more than a decade, since the end of the last century. People called it the global Great Turning, where we're going to the end of this era of dog-eat-dog capitalism with one winner to a new kind of model of cooperation, working together and solving problems as a community.
If I could just add, we wrote an article recently that was published in Truth Out called Capitalism in Crisis, an Opportunity for a New System, and we go into that, what we're describing more in depth there. But one thing we do find that unites us is that the movement is really against, the control of money, the rule of money. It's really about shifting power to the people so that people are making more of decisions over issues that affect their lives.
Now, that economic democracy, you're right, that's been around for, that concept has been around for a really long time. I remember picking up a book of that title, frankly, I can't remember the author, probably 30 years or so ago. I wonder how, in these protests around the world, Marxism is more familiar to people. There's always been, capitalism, versus Marxism. We're not talking about Marxism here, not at all. But are people in these countries that are rising up in protest, are they familiar with the term economic democracy? And is there, A, understanding of it, and B, widespread agreement on, yes, that's the goal, and that's what we'll be, we should be fighting for?
But that's the interesting thing is that there is, and it's really being called the solidarity economy as opposed to being a democratized economy. And there's a whole solidarity economy network that's been growing globally. And actually, the United States is kind of late coming on the scene, but it is really taking off here. The number of people in the United States that are members of cooperatives is around, I think, 130 million now. That includes credit unions. And things like public banks, which have been used around the world, or
right.
There's a movement to try to grow that here. We have one public bank in North Dakota that's been around since early 1900s. So it is something that is more prominent around the world. And what's interesting is an excellent book by John Curl called For All the People. And he kind of shows the roots of this economic democracy or cooperative or communalism type of movement and how it really precedes the Constitution in this country, and
yes,
that the times in history when there's been a rise in interest in this type of economy has mirrored times of social transformation.
Yes, that's true. As you mentioned, before the Constitution, there was a lot of question as to who this new government should serve. Should it serve the creditors, the ones who lend the money and require that the farmers and debtors pay them back, or should it more serve those debtors, the people who, you know, the farmers, the laborers, people like that? That's been a struggle throughout the history of this country. It does seem like one side has largely won over the past 100 or so years.
Well, I would argue that there's more and more historians who look at the beginning of the country and see that the real democracy movement was taken over by the wealthiest landowners, wealthiest lawyers, wealthiest bankers in the country, the founding fathers, who created a kind of a model that put property values ahead of human rights.
Absolutely.
And so what we're involved right now may actually be the completion of the U.S. Revolution, that kind of interrupted by the Constitution being taken over by the oligarchs.
Very, very interesting. Very good point. If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guests today are Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers, who wrote a fascinating article called, let me see if I can find the front of it here, The Subjects of American Empire Are Joining in Solidarity. And certainly the power structure is deathly afraid of democracy. They say that, well, you know, real democracy is chaotic. You don't know which way it's going. You don't know who's going to get the power, which direction it can go in. And, you know, we certainly want to talk about things that are going on across the world. And one thinks most recently of the so-called Arab Spring in 2011, which looked so hopeful for this. And then it seems to have been, I don't know, have taken over, but it went in a direction that my guess is not exactly what so many hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Cairo really intended. And, of course, in Germany in the early 1930s, when there was a tremendous populist uprising against, financial interests and the powers that came down on them after the First World War, obviously that populist movement was taken over by the large industrialists, and you had kind of a bad guy rise up out of that. There's a lot of concern about, you know, the direction that these populist uprisings can take. I wonder if you, Kevin and Margaret, can react to that and give me a little more optimism about that.
Well, we both have thoughts on that. Let me just say that if you go to populistresistance.org and look at the last few days of articles we put up, some of them are about Egypt right now. Egypt is in the midst of a week-long series of protests building up to a major protest next week. And the revolutionaries don't want to see the revolution co-opted again. And these are protests against the Muslim Brotherhood and the Morsi government. It's a one-year anniversary of the Morsi government. And they've actually collected more signatures opposing the Morsi government and the Muslim Brotherhood than the number of people who voted for them. So you're right. That did get taken in a direction that the protesters didn't want to go. But the revolution is not over there. The people there are still working, and the military, of course, is pushing back, threatening to have aggressive arrests on Tahrir Square next week, and so we'll see where that develops. But it's, these things are ongoing struggles. They don't have one dramatic transformation and end. It has to continue and keep fighting. And movements are not a linear project. They don't go in one direction consistently. They're more like waves on the ocean. They hit the shore and then they'll go back. They hit the shore and go back. And sometimes there's a tidal wave. And as Tim DeChristopher, the climate justice activist, said, and as those big waves and you get to the top of the crest and you look both ways, you see you're not alone. And you realize that the ocean keeps pounding the shore, and that's what shapes the shore. And so that's the process we're involved in, and it's an ongoing one. And I really urge you to come to popularresistance.org. That alternate article that you, you cited is a weekly column we have every Friday in alternate that is based on a newsletter we put out through popularresistance.org. If people can sign up and get in their email. But it will give you optimism, because what you'll see is that there is a lot going on. People are active on a wide range of issues. People are uniting. This week we're seeing the Fearless Summer uniting, all these frontline environmental groups that are challenging the extreme energy economy of fracking and tar sands and mountaintop removal, uranium, and all these extreme extraction approaches. Mm-hmm. They're uniting together, and we're seeing more and more of that. That people are showing solidarity with each other.
And I think that you're absolutely right. There's a lot of misinformation out there, as the oligarchs try to kind of fool the people into allowing them to maintain the status quo in one of the, this democracy is chaos. Of course, the oligarchy and the corporate media don't want the people to believe that if they had power, they would actually be effective. So I think it's important to look at places where that's happening, and I think Venezuela is an excellent model where they really started organizing in earnest in the 1990s, community grassroots movement. Out of that came Hugo Chavez, but was really based in creating these community assemblies where people came together to make decisions about what the needs were for the community and who they wanted to have fulfill those needs. And then those community assemblies, some of them started joining into regional assemblies that had greater ability to do the research that they needed on their area and to pool their resources. And that's kind of a foundation of a people's democracy that can rule from below, based in people making local decisions so that, they're the ones who know best what their needs are and how to meet those needs in a way that is sustainable and fair. And, of course, that things are not smooth in Venezuela with, the death of Hugo Chavez and the U.S. challenging the democratically elected next President Maduro. It's an ongoing struggle, but as Chavez always said, the movement was bigger than him, and really he was there because of the movement. And so there's something that's happened there that really can't be defeated, although it's not going to be a straight process getting where they want to go.
That's one thing. As Americans, we feel like we have a right to instant results. We want it now, whatever it is. But you know what? As you say, history doesn't work that way. It never even goes in a straight line, although that's what you were taught in elementary school. I think you're absolutely right, Kevin. It comes kind of in waves and moves in many different directions at the same time. And, how we mentioned that this is not Marxism here. And I got to tell you where this show is coming from, New Hampshire, where there's a lot of conservatives as well as new right-wingers. But amongst the conservatives, it's fascinating that people in some of the more Republican towns were concerned about large water withdrawals, the big corporations, the neoliberal capitalist entities would come in and suck out all the water below them. Well, guess what? People got a little bit upset about that. This is not a Democrat, Republican, left-right thing. People want some degree of control over their water. So I think this can connect with a lot of people. What about the... Go ahead.
There's no doubt. I mean, we've seen that all over the country. The same is true with hydrofracking. People at the local level in rural communities often would be put on the conservative part of the spectrum, are opposing the destruction of their communities for hydrofracking and tar sands. And we're seeing with the tar sands pipeline, ranchers. In fact, the police are describing ranchers in the northern part of the potential tar sands pipeline as terrorists because they're afraid that they're going to be protesting the pipeline. So this is definitely not, these right-left divides are often not there to divide us when we really have a commonality. And you're right, this is not Marxism. In fact, this is a reaction to the failure of state-based socialism and the failure of big finance corporate capitalism. This economic democracy model is one that's very consistent with American values, of individualism, of community, of people having control of their lives, and really of egalitarianism, of people being treated fairly in the economy. So I think this is really you're right, it's been around for a long time, but it takes a long time for our new ideas to gestate, and I think we're at this stage now where there's enough experience with it, enough people directly involved with it, we're starting to see it really getting focused. And I expect as this this resistance movement grows, and it's going to keep growing because the government's not going to respond to people's demands, it's unable to, it's dysfunctional and corrupt. And so as the resistance movement grows in response to that, people are going to get clearer and clearer on what the alternative is. And I think they're going to come to the same place we've come, which is we're going to end the rule of money, shift power to the people, and the economy we need to have an economy that's an economic democracy, and government we need to have more of a participatory government where people are actually involved in making decisions, not solely relying on representative democracy.
What a concept. What a radical, threatening concept. Government of, by, and for the people. Pretty scary. And, you know, again, turning to a lot of the people who were drawn to the Tea Party, you know, they hear the word socialism and, you know, they recoil in horror. But when you talk about the reality is that, as Gore Vidal said so long ago, in this country we've had socialism for the rich and bare-knuckle free market capitalism for everybody else. And this, you know, we have had a government of, by, and for the super rich. It's called a plutocracy for a long time. And, you know, a lot of the people that have been drawn to the Tea Party, I think, see what you think, Kevin and Margaret, might be actually drawn to this, might have a similar impulse that, you know, they want to have power over our own future. So I'm thinking that there may be some points of agreement there. But again, we have people like the Koch brothers who manipulated and, you know, just somehow buy up the agenda, the talking points. You have concerns about that, as I do?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the origins of the Tea Party were because people were recognizing the economic unfairness in this country and the fact that, you know, special interests are making the rules and making them in their interest and not in the interest of the people. What I really like about, you know, the economic democracy is that it's rooted in values. And it's, you know, it's part of this great turning where we're turning away from more of a dog-eat-dog competitive society that we see doesn't work. It continues to restrict, you know, the wealth so that it's going to fewer and fewer people and more people are left out. So
sure,
the economic democracy is really rooted in, you know, people having control over their lives, in, you know, creating communities, creating more sustainable local economies, empowering innovation and entrepreneurship to meet the needs locally. And the Transition Town movement, which is really exciting, that's taking off around the country, is really bringing people from across the ideological spectrum together to start to work together and solve their local problems as we, you know, face climate change. So I do think that these are ways to bring people together and that what we're really looking at is less so kind of conservative versus liberal, but really, you know, what works. We're facing so many crises. We need to focus on what the data show actually works to meet our needs in ways that are consistent with our values.
And that's what's interesting about participatory budgeting. The experience they've had in a number of cities now in the United States and, of course, around the world even more so, is that when they actually get down to making decisions, they go through a process of, here's the things you've seen in our community. We need this safety on this street. We need bike lanes on this road. We need a shower in the park here. We need, you know, various aspects added to our community. And then after they make a list, they set up committees to review each, and they go through a process of looking at what will work to solve that problem. And often it ends up not where they started. For example, I remember early round of participatory budgeting in the district in Chicago. They were worried about crime on the street, and one of the suggestions was video cameras on that street. And they looked into it. The people involved actually came to a totally different conclusion. They found video cameras to be very expensive, not very effective, and that the data showed the most effective thing is better street lighting. And so they put in better street lighting. And, I don't think democracy is as chaotic as people think. What we have right now is pretty chaotic for most people. Most people are struggling to make ends meet. They can't meet a surprise $1,000 expenditure. 60% of Americans can't handle a surprise $1,000 expenditure. That's dental, that's a car, that's your home. It's easy to spend $1,000 these days, and people don't have the money to do it. And so people's retirement is scary. People's health care is scary. That's the real chaos. we're in chaos right now. I suspect that the people actually got involved in making decisions, we actually have a much more clear direction for the country. One of the big challenges we face is something you mentioned, which is how the word socialism has been become one you really can't use. And that's because we live in a very myth-based culture. Both our history and our current news are myth-based. I mean, I hope people will question why when they hear the word socialism, they run away scared. I mean, the reality is we went through a massively long Cold War. Some would say it was a third World War, the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States. It was a classic communism versus capitalism economically, and so that's where and socialism versus capitalism. That's where that fear comes from. And we had the whole Red Scare in the 50s, and people in unions who were perceived as socialists were taken out, so you don't hear their voices anymore. And so we went through a whole process of cleansing that word and scaring people away from it.
Yeah.
Now, we're not advocating socialism, but I think it's important for us to have these words on the table so we can discuss so the best of each idea can be taken. As we said, state-based socialism didn't work. Big finance, corporate capitalism is not working. We need to find something new, and we think that new idea is economic democracy. Sometimes that means a state, something people would call socialism. For example, public utilities.
Right.
Public utilities are much less expensive, produce energy at lower cost, and that would be described as socialist. Some people describe a single-payer healthcare system as socialist, and yet the vast majority of Americans who are on Medicare, which is a single-payer system, love it because it works. And so if you look at the empirical data, which works better? The Veterans Administration, Medicare, or big Wall Street-based insurance. And there's no doubt that Wall Street-based insurance is the most expensive and least effective, produces the worst outcome. Empirically, that's all true. And so we really should be looking at the alternatives that we have in this country that have worked.
And I found it rather amusing being in the New Hampshire State Senate myself, being of the left, certainly, that there was one particular example. It was a private water utility in a large city in the state. And I just sat back while the Republicans said, you know what, we need to municipalize this. We need to have it owned and run by the people. And
exactly.
That was the Republicans talking there. We've been talking mostly about the United States, but there is so much happening around the world in terms of uprisings. I wonder if we could look at some of the specific actions in the worldwide news, and hopefully you, Kevin, and Margaret can offer a little bit of analysis and some clarity. We got starting off Turkey and Brazil. I wonder if you can, I mean, Turkey, it wasn't just about a park, a people's park. What is going on in Turkey?
Yeah, and it's interesting when you said, you know, to your daughter, well, the 60s may be coming back around, because what we know is that, you know, conditions for uprising kind of percolate along as people are treated more and more unfairly and see that the policies are not in their interest, and that, you know, the wealth divide is growing and that there's corruption, and those conditions are all occurring here, and you just don't know what's going to spark it. Certainly those conditions are occurring in countries all around the world. You know, we thought actually we had reported a few weeks before the uprising in Turkey that it seemed like their economy was very stable, but it turns out when you look more in depth, though their overall wealth was growing, so was their wealth divide and the unfairness. And so in Turkey, it was really, you don't know what's going to kind of tip off, like, you know, be the spark that lights that fire of the uprising. And in
uh-huh.
Turkey, it was in Istanbul when there was a decision by the city to build another shopping center in one of their parks and, you know, cut down the trees and bulldoze the park, and the people in the city came out to defend that park, and the police responded quite violently, and it snowballed into a mass uprising that's been going on since the end of May. And Erdogan, the prime minister, has not responded very well at all to that uprising. Rather than kind of saying that, oh, the people are upset, maybe I should figure out what it is that they're upset about, he's cracked down very severely. He, you know, sent out police and full riot gear with these water cannon trucks that had liquefied tear gas and concentration put into the water that was used to shoot at the protesters, shooting tear gas canisters into them. About 8,000 of last count that we got, people, protesters in Turkey were injured, five or six of them killed, 59 of them in critical condition when the doctors came out to set up emergency infirmaries close to where the protests were happening and hotels to take care of them. Police were sent in to take the supplies out of those infirmaries, arrest some of the doctors. what that's done, that crackdown, has actually fueled that resistance there as people see that, you know, this is not right. These are peaceful protesters who are being, you know, killed and injured. And so hundreds of thousands of people have come out all over the country into the streets. And after there was really a pretty serious crackdown on clearing out the protesters, a couple of interesting things happened. At one point when there was marches were banned, the protesters moved, inspired by one performance artist who started this, a standing man protest. Instead of marching, he just stood in front of a picture of the founder of Turkey for 8 hours. And over that time period, people saw him and joined him, and it sparked this whole standing man protest throughout the country. And then they moved into these community assemblies, like we talked about in Venezuela, of communities getting together and meet and saying, hey, you know, what is going on here? And you know, what do we like to see instead? And actually using the same kinds of hand signals that we've seen in all of the movements around the world that use these community assemblies with twinkles up and twinkles down and those types of things. It's like becoming a universal language. And so even out of the initial protest in Gezi Park, a number of, I think it was 180 groups came together and formed what they called Toxin Solidarity, a coalition to negotiate with the government. So it's amazing how out of this one kind of incident of trying to protect the park, it has spurred this nationwide protest. Maybe, Kevin, you've been following more recently in the last couple of days what's going on.
Well, I think also in Brazil. I mean, you know, it's a small increase in the bus fare, and you have a spark and sets off a nationwide revolt. And that, what's interesting about Brazil is, so much to learn from both of these, and I hope we in the United States do learn some. I think from key lessons from both, we first, you don't know it's going to spark the next wave of protests. A small increase in bus fare, national protest. Cut down some trees in the park, national protest. Mark sense of the United States is a tinderbox. There's people protesting all over the country right now, but something is going to bring us together and spark the next round of national protests. And so one thing we want to do is be ready for that. And so I think we have one thing we do on popularresistance.org is put out a strategy of how to achieve real change. And we base this strategy on 100 years of experience with resistance movements. What works, what doesn't, what's the recipe for success? And the short summary of that would be, as Laurie mentioned, you have to do two things at once, protest and build, protest what you don't like, stop the machine, build what you want, create a new world. And that's happening, as I said, in the United States and around the world. But the other thing is you have to be a mass movement. If you're a fringe movement, you're going to fail.
Right.
And one way to become a fringe movement is to be a violent movement. Violence succeeds very rarely in comparison to nonviolence. And there's research on this that proves it. And so I hope people will check out that research. A good book on that is Why Civil Resistance Works. It came out last year, an empirical study. And so nonviolence is more effective. What makes nonviolent movements succeed and fail? The ones that succeed become mass movements. And what I mean by mass movement is it puts forward an agenda that's supported by the majority of people, i.e. and the rule of law.
Money.
And the rule of money. Restore the rule of law. And the rule of money. And the vast majority of Americans would want to see that kind of corruption out of our government. And then it takes really only a small percentage of the population to make it impossible for the government to ignore you. I mean, think of Occupy was about 0.1%, one-tenth of 1%. Of the population, 300,000 to 400,000 people were involved in Occupy. Imagine if we were 1%, 3 to 4 million, or 5%. I say 5% because this research shows that 5% is the tipping point. That's the level where the government cannot ignore you, where even a democratic government or a dictatorial government, if 5% of the public stands up and says no and is persistent in their nonviolent resistance, the government can't ignore you. And so that's not that far away. Brazil, actually that's about 1.5% of their biggest days, about 1.5% of their population is out there protesting.
Wow.
So they probably have the biggest mass protests we've seen as far as numbers of percentage of the population. And look at the reaction of the government. The government, and of course it's a sympathetic government because they come from a progressive perspective and they were revolutionaries themselves with the president, and she's listening and already putting forward ideas that are moving in the direction the protesters want. And the protesters are not backing down; they're being persistent, I think it's very important to be persistent. You can't let a promise be enough. You've got to carry this through until you get what you really want. And so that's another lesson I think that we're learning from Brazil. So these are really interesting developments. And the final thing I'll say about them is just like with Tahrir Square and the Spanish revolutionaries and the Greek revolutionaries who all came before Occupy, they helped to inspire the Occupy movement. I have no doubt that people watching what's going on in Brazil and Turkey and the United States are being inspired by that as well. And I think that will help to bring the next spark of a tidal wave phase of the movement and will help to really bring people together and see they can make a difference. I think we know we can make a difference from the Occupy experience. We changed the debate. We stopped the super committee from cutting Social Security and Medicare. We made a lot of other changes that people don't give us credit for, but we've had an impact already with 0.1%. Imagine when we get to 1% or 5%. The power structure is already afraid of us, and they've shown it. They know they're afraid because they know that they're corrupt. They know that the government is dysfunctional. They're all the people in the power structure are aware of the failings of the current system. So when they see the people starting to react to it, then they get very nervous very quickly.
And there's no.
I just wanted to make a comment, if I could, sure. About kind of the global solidarity that's happening, because when we were organizing the Occupation of Freedom Plaza back in the spring of 2011, that was when Tahrir Square was in, going pretty fully, and we had a conference call with some of the revolutionaries from Egypt, and we were thinking about creating a solidarity statement, and we thought, how could we actually, what would we have solidarity around? And actually, from speaking together through a conference call, we found that we shared very common issues, the desire for fair elections, the desire for, jobs and education and health care, to have human rights respected, to have a foreign policy that was more cooperative and less aggressive. And we created this solidarity document. And there's been kind of, since the Occupy movement, there was a lot of outreach between the United States and other countries, Spain, many of the European nations, Tunisia, Turkey, all these countries that have been in uprising, people from those countries have been seeking solidarity with people who are rising up in other countries. And nonpopularresistance.org, we're contacted regularly by people in other countries who are uprising, who want to send us reports and communicate what's going on there and open these lines of communication. So one thing that's relevant about the Egyptian solidarity is that it did get some media coverage, mostly in Egypt, when the solidarity statement was signed, because we had it signed by prominent members from the United States and Egypt. And one of the Egyptian people that was interviewed in a journal said, what we're going to see is, instead of relations government to government, we're going to see more relations civil society to civil society, because the people are saying that we share this commonality.
And when you talk about when you talk about nonviolence being the only real power, certainly we've seen lots of evidence that if something turns violent, well, guess what? The other side has a lot more experience in dealing with things violently. That's an area that they know. They're familiar with the application of violence. But
no question. And you can really tell that the application of violence or property destruction in a kind of non-strategic way, when you do that kind of thing, it definitely hurts. And you know that because the infiltrators sent in by the governments are often the ones trying to spark the violence, because they want, that's what prevents a mass movement. People don't want to be part of a guerrilla war against the United States.
Right.
That'd be a crazy thing to join, right? Oh, yeah. I mean, who wants to face down that adversary with guns?
No.
I mean, so nonviolence is the way to grow the movement to a movement that can't be stopped.
It's true.
And it's also something that the state doesn't understand. I think John Lennon said it well when he said, that the state doesn't understand nonviolence or humor. And those are really powerful tools for us.
Absolutely.
We're in a David versus Goliath situation here.
Well, my old friend Abby Hoffman used to, recognize that the state, the government, is powerless against humor. If you make fun of them, they don't know what to do. They're completely...
Right, exactly. Mocking them is a very powerful tool, and we've seen that throughout.
And that has turned some revolutions around the world. When you mock the dictator and the dictator shows a reaction, that shows the weakness, and that just turns the whole movement on.
Good point. And certainly in ending the war against Vietnam, it worked. I mean, the fact that Nixon surrounded the White House with buses, Mark, end to end, and inside those buses were troops with machine guns at the ready. This is a fact. It showed that the power of the people on the streets absolutely, absolutely made a difference, really made a difference. And yet...
And it's the only thing that makes a difference. You know, elections don't. I mean, we live in a what we call a managed democracy. It's really a mirage where we get to vote, but our choices are limited to two Wall Street candidates.
Yeah.
All you know, Wall Street wins, no matter which one we vote for. So, Martin Luther King never endorsed a candidate, never expressed any membership in a political party. He had two parties he was dealing with who both supported segregation. We have two parties that we're dealing with that both support corporate power and are funded by corporate power. They're the ones that support the rule of money. So we're not going to get a change from either party. We need to be a mass movement that scares both parties.
And that's one thing I wonder about. You know, since the 1960s, it seems like the powers that be, the owners of the two parties, intentionally dumbed down America. That, you know, and that nowadays there's a heck of a lot more complacency. There's an acceptance of powerlessness. We believe we are powerless. We have come to accept that. And I find that really frustrating. People believe, oh, nothing I can do can make a difference. It is so wrong. And we're seeing it in other countries, you know, not just Turkey, Brazil, but the G8 protests in Europe. Go ahead. Sounds like Margaret.
Well, I was going to say that dumbing down has been very intentional. And I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the Powell memo that came out in 1971. Who was Powell, who was a tobacco lobbyist in Virginia at the time. And in you know, the late 1960s, early 70s, things were pretty chaotic. There were, you know, the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement and the feminist movement and all these, the weathermen that were blowing up, you know, banks.
Yeah.
And a lot was going on. And kind of the market capitalists were concerned that, you know, things were going to, they were losing control. And so Lewis Powell wrote this internal memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce outlining a strategy to take back market control, and shortly after that, you know, six large corporations, TransNet, AT&T, and GE were part of that, and put a lot of money into this campaign that's been very strategic to bring us to the point that we are. In large part, they created think tanks like the Cato Institute and the American Enterprise Institute, and they took over the courts, and they took over the education system, corporatized education, defunded public dollars from education, created great insecurity in our professors. Most of them now are adjunct professors who don't know if they're going to have their job at the next semester. And so, you know, where the universities were really centers of thought and uprising, now they've been really subjugated through kind of this economic control and corporatization and insecurity, plus the student debt crisis that really, you know, makes all of our students feel very insecure when they graduate about whether they can manage that debt and can get a job. It's, you know, turning so many of us into kind of these wage slaves around the country. And another recent study recently showed that 70% of our workers either don't like their jobs or kind of emotionally separated themselves from their jobs and are just performing them. And so, you know, it's a really disempowering environment. But even out of that, people are rising up and joining together and starting to look more strategically for real change.
You can see some of the most dispossessed workers, the low-wage fast food workers at Walmart, McDonald's, Burger King, they're standing up all over the country now. That was unheard of. I really think that's kind of tied to the Occupy movement. You know, as you see people stand up, you get the courage to stand up yourself. So it all builds on each other. I'll just mention one more couple things that Lewis Powell memo. First, he also talked about taking over the media. And I think that's coming down in America. A lot has to do with the false information in the media. The way the media is discussing Snowden is just despicable. You know, David Gregory on Meet the Press going after Glenn Greenwald, you know, suggesting he should be arrested for aiding the release of these documents and aiding Snowden's escape. You know, so it's amazing. I mean, and the other thing I'll mention about Powell was just 3 months after that memo, he was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court. And he served on the U.S. Supreme Court. It wasn't until 2 years after he was on the court that a reporter discovered the Powell memo and released it. So this corporate power planner was put on the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think we've seen the results of a very corporatized Supreme Court. You always hear, you know, whenever there's a nominee for the Supreme Court, you hear lots of questions about their views on abortion or guns or, you know, some other social issue. But you never hear asked, so you're a corporate lawyer. Who were your clients, and what did you charge them? What did you do for them? because that's the real bias. It's really corporate power is the issue, and we need to have our two-party corporate duopoly is not going to be the one that's asked those questions about the next justice and their corporate power connection.
Yeah, and it does seem sometimes like we hire a different CEO between Obama and Romney, but it's the same corporation that they're CEO of. If you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, my guest today, Kevin Zeis and Margaret Flowers of PopularResistance.org and It'sOurEconomy.org. And I got a quote from one of my favorite Americans, Henry A. Wallace, who was vice president of these United States till he was kicked out by the Democratic machine. He said, "Their final objective, toward which all their deceit is directed, is to capture political power so that using the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the common man in eternal subjection." Today, of course, we are in the thick of an epic battle of the truth tellers, the whistleblowers on one side, and the powers that depend on secrecy on the other. What do you think the worldwide ramifications of this are, of this cult of secrecy, and how is that going to play out?
Well, there's a couple points on that one, at least a couple. We have an article on Truthout. We have a weekly column in Truthout as well as an alternately Wednesday column on Truthout, so every Wednesday. We'll focus on how we are all, as subjects of the American empire, how we are all also now subjects to the global war on terror, which includes the United States as part of the battlefield, and that's why we are all part of the dragnet of intelligence gathering.
Sure.
I think this is an opportunity, really, to bring people together in opposition to this kind of abuse. And so I think, once again, by attacking all of us, they also unite all of us. And the other thing I'll mention is the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Ah, yes.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is essentially a global corporate coup. It's been negotiated for 3 years by Obama in secret, except for 600 corporate advisors. Who have been advising him. The lead advisor on agriculture, for example, is Monsanto. So you can expect what kind of food supply we'll have if the Trans-Pacific Partnership becomes law. And groups are uniting around this as well. We're, in fact, going to be announcing a campaign on PopularResistance.org that unites a lot of groups around the country and people around the country to stop the TPP. We believe we can stop the TPP. Lots of trade agreements have been stopped. And we believe this one can be stopped. Even the former U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk, said to Reuters that if people knew it was in the TPP, it would be impossible to get it signed because it's so unpopular. So they're really doing their best to keep a secret and not let people know what's in it, because they know if people know, it's not going to pass. And if we win that battle, that's a battle of the people of the world, not just the United States, people of the world against transnational corporate power. And we win that battle, that will empower all of us to take on the next battle.
Yeah, I think it's really important, your point on secrecy, because there's only one reason for secrecy. It's because they don't want you to know what they're doing.
Right.
And previous trade agreements were done much more publicly, where the text was released. The Trans-Pacific Partnership was being negotiated in secret for the past 3 years. We only know what's been leaked, some of the text that has been leaked. Even our members of Congress have to go through great hoops to be able to even see some of the text, and they can't take notes on it or have a staff person in there with them when they review it. But 600 corporate advisors are able to have real-time access to the text as it's being negotiated so that they can make suggestions to it. So, and when there was a big push during one of the rounds by non-governmental organizations to release the text, the negotiators came out with a memo saying that they would release the text 4 years after it signed into law. So, the secrecy is only for one reason, because they're trying to take over more corporate power in the world, and that's why we're pushing for transparency, we're pushing for a democratic process in the TPP to have actual hearings in Congress and expert testimony. Right now, they're trying to ram it through secretly through a process called fast track.
Yeah, you should know, and some New Hampshire people who believe in the Constitution, the Constitution gives the Congress the authority to negotiate trade. So the fact that they're going to a fast track where Obama negotiates, signs the agreement before Congress sees it, and then Congress down the road gets to approve it or not, is the opposite of what the Constitution stands for. I'll just give you listeners one point about the TPP to give you a sense of what kind of coup this is. They're setting up a whole new trade court system called trade tribunals. And these trade tribunals will have three judges, almost always from corporations, lawyers on leave from their corporation, coming in to rule for the corporation, of course, and then go back to their corporate job. And it allows corporations to sue governments over environmental regulations. If you want to ban hydrofracking or regulate it, if you want to stop tar sands, if you want to give workers a minimum wage, if you want to provide health care, the corporation can go to the trade tribunal and challenge that. And so it almost makes it impossible for a government to put in place laws that favor the public interest, because anything for the public interest will be challenged by the corporate interest, and they'll be in the courts that are rigged for their favor. And so this is a real coup that needs to be stopped, and I think everybody in the United States should be up in arms about it and really doing all they can to stop this coup. The two things we request at the beginning: one, release the text. People need to know what's being negotiated in our name. And two, no fast track. We want the constitutional checks and balances to be in place so there can be hearings, witnesses, and amendments suggested. We need to have those two first steps, and hope that people will join us at the popularresistance.org campaign to stop the TPP.
And it does seem that, you know, amongst genuine conservatives, not the Koch brothers directed right wing, but people want to feel like we have some power over our future. You know, if it affects us, we ought to be able to participate in that decision making. And that's certainly been happening when it comes, as you talk about extraction around the world, you know, the Alberta tar sands, there's timber rights, you know, between the corporations there and the First Nations, massive hydro projects on one side, and the Cree Nation on the other. There's the people from the Amazon versus big oil, and our uranium comes from generally powerless people in formerly French West Africa. And it seems like there is some sort of a thread that ties this together, some sort of a solidarity. And the people of the world must be seeing, hey, what's going on with America being so obsessed with secrecy? You know, I see a lot of the people of the world getting it. They've been, you know, at effect of American imperialism for much longer than we have. And maybe the people of America are waking up to this by seeing people around the world.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the threads that really unites us for all this is the extraction economy. And, we write about this in our article, Capitalism in Crisis, Opportunity for a New System, because, you know, we live on a finite planet, and we can't continue to extract resources from this finite planet. We have to find other ways of doing things, and, you know, we can do that. So you see that right now with here with summer going on, the people that have been fighting the Alberta tar sands and hydrofracking and mountaintop removal are all joining together and working in solidarity to try to fight this extraction economy and push for a more sustainable economy based on renewables. And the uranium, interesting that you bring that up, because it's not just Africa that's being affected by this. Actually, all of us in the United States affected by the uranium mining, because the greatest amount of uranium in the U.S. is on tribal land. And during the period after World War II, during the Cold War, private corporations went into this tribal land and actually started extracting uranium in very unsafe ways. They did these huge open-pit uranium mines that they abandoned today and continue to put out radioactive material and heavy metals into the air, land, and water. And that travels, of course, through the country and affects all of us. So that's another area that we need to be aware of. It's being actively suppressed. The federal agencies know that these open pits are there and that they're poisoning, but they don't want to do anything about it because it's most expensive and because it would hurt the economies of the states. It would hurt their tourist industry. And tourists know they were going into areas that were highly contaminated. So it's this extraction economy that really brings us together around the world and around the country.
And again, you know, we ought to be able to participate in decisions which affect us all. We got to wrap up here. Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers, your article ends on a very hopeful note. You say, and this is just one of many articles, obviously, progress is being made toward the world we want every day by millions of people around the world. You are not alone. You are part of a worldwide movement. Might this be a little bit of wishful thinking?
Well, you know, every week we write this article, this is a newsletter, and we are always surprised every week when we start to look at what's happening in the United States and around the world about how much is happening, because the media isn't covered, so most people don't know about it. But when you actually are looking for it and you're part of this movement and you start to report on it, it's amazing how many people are involved in trying to do create the new world, whether it's through resistance or creation. People, and it is millions of people, are actually active in trying to make this kind of positive change.
And they're making connections and working together in that struggle. So we feel very hopeful.
Well, that's always wonderful to hear. Kevin Zeiss and Margaret Flowers, popularresistance.org. They also co-direct itsoureconomy.org. Is that what it is?
Itsoureconomy.us.
It's ourEconomy.us. Thank you.
And all of our articles are posted on clearingthefogradio.org.
Clearingthefogradio.org. We are not alone. We are part of a worldwide movement. Thank you so much. Very informative, and it's nice to have a sense of uplift in some troubling times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bert.
There's a new world coming near, singing loud and clear. Revolution, feel that rumbling along the ground. It's a mighty sound. Revolution, it's the sound of the morning dove. People
you enjoyed that last song. It was obviously called Revolution from a movie of the same name from 1967.